concentrated performance and not the less beautiful part. We turn now to a man whom I have to admire at a distance in a certain sense. I'm an economist, and this man's scholarship has overwhelmed me all the time. It's true, and I'm very happy that you have come up from the enclave down the bay to talk to us. Our next speaker, Professor Stephan Posonic.
Thanks very much. To give a status report on the generation of peace, I think we should remember the great expert on the subject, Maurice Chevalier. He told the story of the chauffeur who picked up Madame la Marquise at the railroad station. And so she asked her how are things, and she says, things are wonderful. Tout va bien, Madame la Marquise. She said, well, you're glad to hear this. Now, how's the dog? Well, the dog isn't so good. In fact, he was run down by a fire truck. How come that? I mean, after all, the dog didn't run around loose. Yeah, well, tout va bien, but there was a big fire in the house. Oh, she says, well, that's bad. Now, what happened to that? Well, not very much, but unfortunately, Monsieur le Marquis died in the fire. What else happened in the house? Well, all your money and the valuables you had in there were burned. Well, she says, but it's horrible. She says, no, he answers, it's not so horrible. Tout va bien. I'm still here. I'm your loyal chauffeur, and from here on out, everything will be fine. There's no real change in the status of the world. As Tony pointed out, troubles continue. Conflict is the root of certainly international life. Some troubles fade out, some new ones come in. A few days ago I gave a speech, and in order to shorten the proceedings, I rolled out the threats against the United States. I'm not going to read them to you. But I just want to point out it's four pages, single space, just listing of what threats we are confronting. Now, one of the main things, of course, is the Soviet Union, despite SALT, or perhaps because of SALT, continued to arm. Now, we have in this country reasonably good military and technological strategists, and from time to time they put one over. Put one over on Congress and on the President, the civilian advisors, and the press even. And as a result of these little tricks the military and the technologists have played, we have been keeping ahead in the game of technology. Whether this can continue, I don't know. But so far, despite the figures of course Tony quoted some of them, we have still a number of advantages, and we hope to keep them. The Soviets, however, tried to capture the technology superiority and the quantitative superiority, some of which they have got. But it's a sort of a race between the hare and the hedgehog. That is, that hare runs like crazy from wins it, and then the time he arrives at the line, where it has its hedgehog there, and he was always there for it. And the Soviet Union, so far, has not won the race. It will be very difficult for them to win it, for the simple reason that in a nuclear confrontation, the warning that we do have, the warning systems which we have and they don't have, incidentally, made it quite impossible to launch a first strike successfully. But lest you misinterpret that, I may hasten to add that this very situation, which is of great advantage in the particular segment of the conflict, which is in a way the most important, but still is only a limited segment, That particular situation facilitates the application of Soviet strategies of a different type in all other areas, and this is not taken care of a particular scale. Now, specifically, the Soviet preponderance in Europe at the present moment is really staggering. It may not be all that bad if their tanks aren't worth very much, but there's a sort of a forlorn hope to assume this, but the tank superiority is certainly 4-1. in Europe, and the number of tanks Soviets put in is constantly rising. As a result of this, not even mentioning the short-range missiles and other weapons, including air power, which they may have the superiority in, the NATO alliance is creaking, collapsing, revitalizing, and dying again, and in a hell of a bad shape. And the reason for that, in part, is that our strategy is not responsive to what the problem is, and also the reason, to a greater extent, is that our diplomatic strategy is really pretty lousy. Now we have what Tony made his remarks on, and detente. He mentioned the computers. I wrote them down too. One of the meanings of the detente policy at the present moment for the Soviets is to get hold of our computer technology. Now what this precisely means, we don't have time to get into, but the fact is, at the present moment, in all this talk about how well advanced the Soviets are in so many fields, incidentally, we have a little script down on the table, which gives a comparative statistics, and I want to caution you against accepting those statistics. The Soviets look much better on some of those statistics here than they actually are. But in the area of computers, they're way behind. And without our help, and without the British help, they are not going to get very far for the foreseeable future. And as long as their computers are not good, a lot of their military equipment isn't that good either. And they know this, of course. You don't have to tell them, they tell you. So they go out and make no bones about this. This is you may think this is a very secret type of a conversation. Not at all. They come out and want the computers, and in fact, buying computers for so-called non-military applications. And we don't have, in this country, which is probably will remain the world's top technologist, we don't have technological strategists. There just isn't a single one around who has a position of power. Those people who are in power don't understand technological strategy. I would say two-thirds of the trouble behind right at this point. The food problem was mentioned. The food is not all that important. What is really important is that the Soviets, to some extent, to a higher extent, the Chinese, need a lot of capital transfers. If they don't get the transfer from us, from our friends, they're in trouble. Again, this is not a classified secret. This is a talked about situation. And we have no economic strategists who might take advantage of this situation. What it boils down to is the Soviets need it, so can we supply it and to what extent? Well, that isn't really the problem. The Soviets need it, now how can we exploit this particular situation for our purposes? This question is rarely asked. So, we don't have strategies to take care of these situations, or exploit the opportunities we have. And the fact of life is that while we are bemoaning Watergate and similar things, the Kremlin is also in a crisis, has been for years. The indicators of the crisis have been quite massive. But we have no effective psychological operators, and those who are in the business wouldn't know what a term like, let us say, psychological ascendancy really means. We have had a policy associated with Nixon and Kissinger on the whatever you want to call it, the relationship between us and Peking. Well, at the present moment, the signs again are very massive that the Maoists are turning back toward a internal tactic of cultural revolution. Turned eyes on the skids. It was announced in the Chinese press that he will be less active in future. Cultural revolution should be welcomed by us because they're doing a good job in cutting their own throat. That's all right, no worry about it. But there's another side to it, and that is if they again become crazier than they are at the present moment, then of course the danger of a military explosion along the Sino-Soviet border is growing. We have a fairly good capability in this country of watching China. Our sinologists are very high quality. But the Chinese problems as such are way beyond the head of most of our policymakers, and as a result of this, our China policy is not properly thought through. The basis of it is, of course, to take advantage of the Sino-Soviet conflict, which is real, and which is going to stay around, and which is perhaps one of the most significant factors in life. I never tired to make this particular statement, which leads many of my friends to say, well, he's either crazy, or he's gone soft on communism, or he falls for deception, and so on and so forth. But I put it to you that this is an indication in our camp that the China problem is way over the head of many people. So that conflict continues. It is a factor which helps us. The greatest contribution to American strategy in this sense is really the honoriness of the various communists. So keep them alive as honorary types they are. But we are not properly taking advantage of the opportunity here either. A mention was made by Tony and by myself also on the European trouble and ineptness of our diplomacy. Well, the fact of life, in addition to it, is that there are very bad subversive trends in virtually all of the European allied countries. Notably, however, in the three important ones, West Germany, UK, and France. The French situation is a little better under control now than it was, but it's deteriorating again, and the situation in Germany is really horrible, and largely a matter of subversive activity. And in England, if you haven't been there for a while, you don't quite expect to see what you find when you go there. This is a country which at the present moment is torn apart by a large number of conflicts. British still have their sense of realism, so they keep it under some sort of control. But the fact is, you have an ethnic struggle now, which is so visible that it's really painful to watch it. And keep in mind that, for example, in this miners' strike, which now turns out had been caused by a mistake in arithmetic on the part of the government, which is sort of really hard to believe, this miners' strike is in part an ethnic problem. Most of the miners are fellows from Wales. And if you think that that's not noticed and that it isn't one of their motives, you're mistaken on it. And we have no strategists in this country who can handle defensively subversive operations, that is, who can overcome subversion. And, just to tell you a short story, I wrote a piece on this great top subverter in Germany, Herbert Wehner, who is not even recognized by the American press as the man he is, namely the fellow who runs Germany today. He's not even the government, but he is the ruler of Germany, certainly insofar as the major decisions are concerned. Herbert Wehner used to be not only the third man in the German Communist Party, but he was also a chief of one of the Rote Kapelle networks, that means something to you. One of the major espionage operations during the war. He didn't by any chance leave the Communist Party, but he was kicked out because he was a traitor. Now here's a fellow the communists didn't want, you know. Now he's the second, he's the first man in Germany today and has made his peace with the communists last year because he's obviously doing a good job for them. I put this up to some people, I didn't in fact put it up myself, but a friend of mine, a German, put it up to one top American cabinet member and said, well, isn't that a little McCarthy act? It's the reaction. So if the people have this sort of a reaction, I didn't mean doing it, then how in the dickens are we going to prevent that West Germany is taken over by the operation that is taking place today, which is done very, very skillfully, has fading out to some extent, but it's not over by any means. Now, Mr. Allende is out of business. He got out of business because he was unable to run the place properly. But far from being a great success to our side, the side of freedom, the overthrow of Allende became a good propaganda advantage to the communists. We have no psychological strategy which would take advantage of a situation which is basically a victory of our side, and the victory on our side is within a few weeks transformed into a shaming of our side and basically a new impulse into the fight for socialism coming. Middle Eastern war. Just 2 points. We failed to live up to our commitment to ship arms to maintain the proper balance. No two ways about it. And we not only failed to commitment in the quantitative sense, but especially in the qualitative sense. There was no reason not to send out proper anti-tank weapons, for example, when we knew that there were these many tanks there. But the second point is, there was, of course, a breakdown in not in the military intelligence, but in the political intelligence, and it's always the same sort of a breakdown. We always assume the other guy is going to be so crazy as to launch a military attack. Well, that's exactly what he's going to do if he thinks the situation is right, and for that matter, if there's a good reason to attack, and there was an excellent reason for the communists at that time. And this connection, the intelligence on the oil situation was pretty disastrous. There was no effective strategy toward the Arabs. On that one, this is obviously a speech of several hours. Let me just point out one fact to you, which is, again, I'm not really assigning too much strategic validity to the point, but to show you the cultural climate in which we operate. Now, in the Middle East, there are a lot of Christians. In Egypt, the main minority which run Egypt till Nasser kicked it out, are the Copts, who are Christians. Now, if you listen to all the discussions about the Jewish Muslim, or Jewish Arab as you want, a confrontation, you wouldn't know that there are these Christians in the Middle East, notably in Egypt, in Lebanon, and in Syria. No one ever pays any attention to these people. The Copts have been oppressed by the Nasser regime, now the situation has a little bit improved, for about 20 years. We never even considered. Enough said on this, just to show you that we approach all these things in a perspective, narrowed down to a few points, and it's usually the narrowing is usually in the sense of what the other guy wants us to narrow. Terrorism. Okay, this is a hard one to handle, but the fact of life is we have no effective police organization in this country, we have no effective internal security in this country, and no one gives a good goddamn, and the problem isn't even discussed. Now here's the great electronics capital of the world, Pakistan, on the peninsula. You would think that one way to go about it is to get proper electronic instrumentation, which would provide a better security in the home. Nothing of the sort is happening. The energy crisis. The energy crisis has been coming in a way or the other, or whatever you want to call it, but the need for more energy resources on it's really one of the oldest chestnuts in the business. My own experience, 22 years ago, we were concerned with that in the Pentagon. We ran a whole set of briefings on it. That's why we instituted the Adams for Peace program. Why do you think we instituted it? Two reasons. The knuckleheads wanted to close down the production of fissile materials. So we were looking for a good reason why we wouldn't close it down. Well, we found it because there is this energy problem there. So the Adams for Peace program was invented. It was invented in the Pentagon and had to be pulled down the throat of the EEC, which was officially, legally in charge of developing nuclear electric power. Never did a damn thing about it, even though they put Mr. Lilienthal, the great boy of the TVA, in charge for this very purpose. Never budged from it. Well, that's an aside, generally shows you how this government is really run. There was no rational action on this energy problem, which was, of course, arising over this whole period, and finally we find ourselves in difficulty. Now, in fact, the actions that were taken, many of them were counterproductive. Price controls, the stupid way in which, let's say, the shale problem is being handled, etc. Inflation. If you go over history, you can summarize in one point. A governmental system, can be destroyed by war, or it can be destroyed by inflation or by the two combined. So this is fundamentally what it's all boils down to. Revolution I didn't mention. Well, of course, a revolution is either connected with a war, notably a defeat, or it springs out of an inflationary situation or an economic trouble, which is essentially an inflationary problem. Again, they're usually combined. Now, Milton Friedman identified the causes of inflation. When I read what he had to say about it, he said, Jesus, I heard this before, and I did. In fact, he acknowledges it. That's, it's a heroic stuff. You find this in Mises, you find this in the German inflation of 1920, or let's say the Weimar's inflation was stopped in 1923, etc. Now, there's no secret about what causes inflation or what inflation is. And who does anything about it? No one. He identified the causes. There's no argument against him that has been produced, which I know of, which knocks him down. His own student, Schultz, is in charge of the inflation level. He knows what Friedman says, and he does try to do something about it, but nothing happens. Now we get, of course, into something which is really a new thing, and then that one, the old Chevalier story, it's no longer quite true. This is added on. And that is the collapse of the currencies, in plural, all of them. Because that is the inevitable outcome of the change in the oil prices. The estimates of the deficits for the various industrial countries range, government deficits, the government calculations and private calculations, between 32 billion a year, that's the lowest I have seen, to up to $95 billion. And it's quite clear that the system cannot handle this sort of thing. So the problem is recognized. We understand there's something with the gold. Of course, we immediately have legislation. Not immediately, we have had legislation for the last 40 years which prevents us from taking advantage of the hedge which gold offers. So we hurt ourselves. No one else has that stupid legislation. We do. Action is taken now. It's under discussion. Nobody talk about it. But it's obviously the action too little too late. This is a dramatic situation which would call for emergency steps. Long and short of it, and I can assure you, all economists who are here, there are no financial strategists. So there are no strategists who deal with the whole financial structure. And I just simply tell you that for years, many people concerned with strategy have tried to find those economists, and they just don't exist. You find very good economists, but as soon as you get into the matter of strategy, they put them out. All of our problems, nevertheless, are solvable. Namely, we can avoid war and we can get rid of communism. If we avoid war without getting rid of communism, we will not avoid war, so we have to do both. We can keep the free world together. We can get all the energy we want. As of now, unlimited resources of energy, potentially available. We must get stable currency. The United States government does not produce the required strategists. It is too cumbersome at the present moment to take effective action. The top in the government does not control the bureaucracy, which largely follows the rate of Parkinson's law. The political decision makers are demagogues, whatever else they may be. They strap themselves with their demagoguery, such as a generation of people. Yet, don't be disheartened. With all these struggles, tu vas bien. because there's one secret here, and that is that the American system, you might call it the institutions of the society, and that thing still works by itself. And it might work better if the government wouldn't move it about all the time, but it is working and the government isn't all that powerful. And it is progressing, and it makes it moves on. Technology, for example, is an impersonal force. 10 McNamara's couldn't destroy it. And to make it a little nicer, even the Soviet system doesn't. So we will probably survive, because not because we have the fittest system, but we have the least unfit system. The question is, however, which confronts us now, whether after the realistic conservatives have lost their chance once again. This is what we did now. Conservatism had a big promise a few years ago. Right now, it's down low and has no chance at the present moment, unless a miracle happens by supernatural dispensation. But the question is whether in 1976, 200 years after, the lemmings will take over. I think you might begin to think about these people really in terms of their being lemmings. And then, of course, if the lemmings will take over, we will have a strategy, the lemming strategy of self-destruction. Final point on this. This conflict, like any other conflict, will be won by will, endurance, conviction, courage, by moral factors. In the mind, it is not a matter of matter. What you need in the material sphere, you produce because you have it pre-shaped in the mind. Now that, it's not the case that we lack the brains in this country. We have more than enough. Well, not that that's a foolish statement. We never have more than enough, but we have an adequate number of first-rate brains. But we do not have a system to select, let alone to elect them. So, with a very last point, insofar as the conservative movement is concerned, I think that just a good place to begin thinking about these matters is by looking at our own schizophrenia, about the concept of the state, the concept of the presidency, which was already discussed this morning. And really, we have to have a proper answer, which we don't have at the present moment, to this question: what is the proper state structure in the United States which will allow us to survive in the next generations of powers?